Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 10th of May 2015. My name's TRP Watson, and this week I'm joined by Paul in London, Phil from West End Whingers, Johnny Fox, Web Cowgirl, and Julie Raby. We're now going to talk about Carrie at the Southwark Playhouse. This musical is based on the novel by Stephen King, with music by Michael Gore, lyrics by Dean Pitchford, and a book by Lawrence D. Cohen. This musical famously was done by the RSC back in 1988 and was a complete disaster. However, in 2012, the writers of this reworked the whole thing. I think they've added in an extremely large number of new songs. I think something like 12 or something I've heard. And this production is directed and choreographed by Gary Lloyd. Paul, tell me more about this production, what you thought of it.
Well, actually, it's quite fascinating, really, Tim. It's really almost a Gothic-style musical, because it does take the subject matter quite seriously, even though at times you are chuckling to yourself at some of the craziness of the piece. I actually think that's probably part of the intention. And one of my thoughts after seeing this show was actually they could have pushed the humor a lot more and sort of gone for a humor horror type effect. But as you said at the beginning, Carrie, how I knew about it was from this wonderful book, Not Since Carrie, 40 Years of Musical Flops, which is a wonderful book about how some musicals just don't work, and it sort of speculates on why they didn't work. And it opens with Carrie, and it goes into a great detail of it. And it was interesting rereading that after seeing Carrie, that actually while a lot of the songs have been added into the piece, the basic structure has stayed the same. And it's actually quite interesting, I think, if you've seen the original and then to compare just how a few tweaks to any show can actually make it something better than what it was originally. And from talking to people that had seen it on Wednesday night, I think one of the key criticisms in the previous version was that it was too stylized and it was too remote and the direction was quite preposterous. Here, this is a lot more realistic, and basically it's quite a simple story, really, because Carrie is bullied at school. She discovers she has powers. Her mother is a religious fanatic, and something's got to give, I guess, is best the way to describe it. If you're not familiar with the story, I won't give away what happens, but needless to say, at the very end, it is quite spectacular. There is lots of blood. There are lots of incredible special effects. And I think, you know, the music is actually quite good. The creative team, directed by Gary Lloyd, who also did the choreography, you know, keeps the energy up quite a lot. And the cast are fantastic. I think particularly Kim Criswell, who plays the overbearing mother, is a theatrical event in her own right, really. She goes from singing beautifully sweet gospel to grabbing Carrie and throwing her through a trap door. It just the juxtaposition of the two sort of sweet character then one minute and then psychotic character next is fascinating to watch, and also quite hilarious. And also Evelyn Hoskins as the lead role in Carrie, she is quite mesmerizing, both in her physical appearance. She has this incredible sort of ability to sort of hunch over, look down, and then when she looks up and gives a stare, she looks quite creepy in her own right. And then when she actually starts showing off her powers, it's quite an impressive feat. So all told, I think the show is quite interesting from a musical theatre history point, but perhaps it does take a bit long to get going, and I'm not quite sure there's much you can do about that because of the nature of the story and the way they've chosen to tell it. Having said that, the cast are fantastic, and the music is actually quite interesting to listen to, so I quite enjoyed it.
Phil, what did you think?
Well, I saw the original production at Stratford because it was a joint sort of production between RSC and American producers, I believe. And that was everything you've heard. It was truly appalling. So it really had nothing to beat. And if I say it's better than the original, then that really is damning it with faint praise. But I didn't enjoy this either. One of the problems I have with it is that I didn't like the sort of the soft rock music because it was such an assault on the ears. And also the sound, I was sitting on one of the side banks, which because it's staged and on a sort of thrust stage, and only ensemble numbers, really could hear very few of the lyrics. And even in the quieter songs, particularly the ones between Carrie and her mother, I'd sometimes strain to hear that. One number they actually had to compete with not only the band, but a thunderstorm going on, which is quite something. And I just think if you can't hear a show and they've got that wrong, I mean, I did see the last preview, but even so, I feel that I couldn't imagine that it got considerably better overnight. So that was a problem for me. I didn't particularly like the songs either. I don't find anything memorable about it. And it's kind of sounds a bit dated as well, I think. Having said that, I do agree with you about the two central performances of Kim Criswell and Evelyn Hopkins. Yeah.
Yep.
And I thought they were terrific. The scenes with them together were the best scenes for me because they did create a sort of a creepy tension between them. And yeah, Evelyn Hopkins, her sort of hunched appearance throughout, she's so incredibly repressed and sort of humiliated. And when she does that stare, which she does quite a lot, it's you never get tired of seeing it because she really is. I know she was in Spring Awakening, but for me, she's a complete find. She's the star of the night for me, even though Criswell sings very well as well. But I just thought that it's kind of a messy kind of show. The tricks for me, the trickery, I wasn't particularly impressed by it. A few of the bits worked. And it does have a proper spectacular, the prom night scene, which, without giving too much away, is done properly. Whereas in the original, they used red lights to represent blood, which was just thinking, why? Because I remember the set at Stratford was this white sort of plastic box. And when you know you see it for the first time, you think, oh, great, there's going to be blood and it's easy to wipe off. But they didn't do that. And it was very stylized. And I remember the opening number, because I think we were sitting in the second row of the stools. The people in front of us, the moment it began, put their fingers in the air because it was just a bombardment of noise. And it was almost like springtime for Hitler. Our mouths just dropped open and we looked at each other and thought, what the hell is going on? In terms of what I remember, I do remember it quite well. The show opened with the school children, the girls, doing a sort of cheerleader type number, which leads into the famous menstruation scene where she's having her first period, or Carrie's having her first period and doesn't know what it is. And she's sort of bombarded with tampons, which does we do see in this production. But in the Southwark Playhouse production, it begins with one of the school children being interviewed by presumably the police, which I thought, oh, hang on, they've turned it around quite well. And it leads into that scene afterwards. So they sort of got this topping and tailing structure of the girl being interviewed, which was a much better way of bringing you into it. But I still think it's really, really, it's still, for me, a bit of a horror. I couldn't say I really enjoyed it. I appreciated the performances, especially the ones I've mentioned. But I still think it's got huge problems. And again, the sound was so bad, it was difficult to really tell whether the songs were any good or not, because I couldn't hear the lyrics.
So, John, what did you think of this?
Well, I think I'm probably going to echo largely what Paul and Phil said, because equally, I had no exposure to this. I knew the book Not Since Carrie that Paul talked about, but I'd been pretty unexposed to the show or to their other work, because I don't think I've ever seen Dean Pitchford and Michael Gore's Footloose or Fame either. But I know they do belong to this kind of High School Musical genre, of which this is another slightly different version. I mean, it is wonderful that we are back in the Southwark Playhouse happy space, which is reviving either in-house as a Daniel Tarantino production or here in partnership with Paul Taylor Mills, the prolific young producer who's also a bit of a protege of Bill Kenwright, shows which tanked firmly on Broadway and then giving them very fresh energy in this more intimate format where hopefully the book, music and lyrics can speak for themselves. But I think the problem with Carrie is that the book, music and lyrics really have nothing to say. And I think it's the fault of the book mainly. If you read the original novel, it's Stephen King's debut novel, and it's epistolary. It's written in a sequence of correspondences and documents and things like that from which you pick up the history of the story. And I think in a way that they slightly returned to that in this production, because they have the interviews at the beginning and the end with the character of Sue, who is the sort of only girl in the gang who is remotely kind to Carrie and in fact, you know, sympathizes with her, and she's the one who arranges for her boyfriend to take Carrie to the dance. I just think the novel has more depth and complexity and more character than, well, almost even than the film, although the film is much closer, but certainly than the musical's book. And you do have pretty banal bones of a high school musical left. And this, I'm not so keen as Paul on the music, you know, but I find it a sort of generic pop rock score, and promise you, you know, if you've seen it, you really won't be Spotifying it when you get home to find the bits that you missed, even the lyrics that you missed through Southwark Playhouse's unforgivably bad sound system. The other thing I want to take issue with is Gary Lloyd's decision to update the show from the 70s to contemporary times. Yes, that gives you lots of opportunities for the kids to sort of posture around with their mobile phones, but it really defeats its own purpose. You know, if you're a 21st century, what was that movie about all the high school girls bullying each other? Heathers. So if you're a 21st century Heather, you're not going to be happy with this level of persecution. You know, they'd be hacking Carrie's Facebook feed or spiking her school lunch with animal tranquilizer. Or, you know, there will be some sexual abuse. So a little bit of name calling and some tampon throwing. Well, frankly, it looks amateur because it's been contemporized, and we are now used to teenagers being even much more cruel to their peers. So, you know, I think we could have had some teenage boys hazing in a locker room if they really wanted to pull in the sort of above the stag crowd to this. But in terms of the performances, yes, absolutely concur. Evelyn Hoskins is this wonderful study of a round-shouldered, no-neck, green cardigan misery. And she maintains this focus, you know, for a long time. Although she sings both her ballads and the soul number really outstandingly well, it just takes too long for the first act for the story to unfold or for her powers to be unleashed. And so she's kind of left staring determinedly from under this ginger mop of a wig for over an hour. And I think she could be given her head a little bit earlier and they could compact the first half quite a lot, because although there are a number of different characters, they sort of swirl around her like a kind of teenage soup. And the other characters, who could be quite a bit more interesting and are developed more in the film, just aren't really explored and exposed in the stage musical. Although there are some good performances among the rest of the cast. And I would certainly single out Jodie Jacobs playing Miss Gardner, the gym teacher, with a kind of slight nod to Sue in Glee, as a very, very subtly sapphic gym teacher in a tracksuit. But I liked her interactions with Evelyn Hoskins. They just had the right measure of support and kindness without it being either gloopy or in any way inappropriate. I think we should also mention Sarah McNicholas, who plays Sue, the only character. The character is interviewed by the police at the beginning and the end of the show, and who is the only one who first of all takes pity on and then slightly befriends Carrie and arranges for her sort of jock boyfriend to take Carrie to the prom. So nice work from Sarah McNicholas, but also by Greg Miller-Burns playing the high school hero. I think he was more kind of geeky and less sort of obviously the buff football player that he perhaps is in other castings. But I liked him very much. When he was in the mode of being gentle and kind with Carrie, he really did seem to make it appear that he was being lovely to her and that there was a possibility that they might be friends. And that was very gently and very pleasantly done. But, you know, like the other two say, salvation in this piece is found, salvation in all its forms, is found in the power and the glory of Kim Criswell's performance. It is barnstorming. I cannot now think of a better casting for the Piper Laurie part from the movie. She is, first of all, I think she does the part too many favours, because when she presents the sort of gospel persona and you find her first singing along to the radio, singing hymns, it is so beautiful that you warm to the character in a way perhaps the production doesn't intend you to. And really what you want to happen is that they'll just sort of stop all the action for a bit and you could just listen to Kim sing gospel for the rest of the night because it is so lovely. But then, you know, once Carrie defies her, she is, you know, aggressive and strange and mountingly, thrillingly full-voiced in the rest of her numbers, right up to the grand guignol of the blood-soaked climax, which I thought they did extremely well. There's a fine line to be walked here between playing up to the story and spilling over into schlock. And I think they chose to do it as realistically as the confines of Southwark Playhouse and the constraints of special effects would allow. And I really do think that they have invested in just the right things to give the show the measure of shock and horror that it requires. And I have to say that I am, every time I open a theatre programme and I see the words Flying by Foy, this wonderful company that, you know, first of all launched 1,000 Peter Pans, but then, you know, went on to do great work for big stage musicals and events all over the world. It does make my heart beat a little faster to know that there's going to be this particular kind of mechanics. And I know it didn't work on Press Night, but Kim Criswell was indeed flying, walking in the air from the following evening, and it's been fine ever since. So I think this is it's not a great musical, but it is a great evening out. And that, as I say, is the justification of what Southwark Playhouse and its partners seem to be able to do. You know, it worked with Bat Boy and it's working with Carrie. So I do recommend it.
We're now going to talk about The Vote, which is a play written by James Graham and directed by Josie Rourke at the Donmar Warehouse. This play is a comedy set in a polling station and is probably better thought about because of its meta-theatrical things rather than itself as a play. The idea that the play starts at 8:30, goes on for an hour and a half until 10:00, which is when the polls close. So it's as if you're watching something happening in real time, the whole voting process. And also the other part of that is the inclusion of an awful lot of guest actors and guest stars coming in to cast their vote and sometimes just coughing slightly, something that Josie Rourke said. The cast, I think, is somewhere around 40, although the main cast here is Mark Gatiss, Catherine Tate and Nina Cesonia. Phil, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
Well, I saw it. I haven't seen it on TV yet, although I am going to watch it, and I'm going to watch it soon, because otherwise the moment will go. I think the fact that it was such a unique event and idea, I mean, I applied for tickets appropriately enough in a ballot to get tickets, and I happened to get them for what was the very first performance, or you could call it the first preview. And they did a two-week run at the Donmar, and then went live on television on election night on the 7th of May and were performing it for the last 90 minutes of the polls being open, when, of course, we didn't know the result. Of course, everybody does now, which adds a slight difference to the play. And I know there were going to be rewrites as it was going on, small rewrites. But I have to say, there was a real feeling of excitement when I saw it, because, you know, not just because it was the first performance, but the whole thing about the timing. And James Graham, the writer, and Josie Rourke came on and made a brief introduction and speech explaining the concept that they'd done two dress rehearsals, one which had run slightly over, one slightly under, but they had to get it spot on for the time. And then they left the stage and we watched the onstage clock ticking down to 8:30 when the play actually began. And it did end, or it seemingly ended, at bang on the dot of 10:00, which is how it would be when it went out on television. And that, to me, I think, is just such a great idea. It's fantastic. I know, you know, plays sometimes would go out live on television, but to have it with an audience as well, and this to time it with something that was really, really happening, and a particularly interesting election, as it happened in the end, I think just full marks for them to even conceiving the idea and pulling it off as successfully as they did. I mean, it's sort of a slight farce comedy, without giving the plot away for those who have not seen it yet on TV or going to watch it. Basically, Mark Gatiss runs the polling station, and Catherine Tate and Nina Cesonia, who I didn't know until, but I hadn't realised that she's in W1A, are the sort of the ones handing out the ballot papers. And something goes horribly wrong, which then they try and rectify. And by trying to rectify it, as in, you know, good comedy does, it just makes the situation much, much worse. And throughout this hour and a half, we have various people who, you know, quite a starry cast building up to Judi Dench coming on at, for the last 18 minutes with Finty Williams, her real life daughter, playing mother and daughter. And they managed to work the plot that it keeps them on till the very end. So there is this kind of anticipation of Judi Dench coming on. But, you know, in the meantime, we get people like Jackie Clune, Pandora Cullen, Hadley Fraser and Rosalie Craig, who are real-life husband and wife, Bill Paterson, Timothy West, and a host of others, and apparently in the TV version, Jude Law, who didn't appear when I saw it. So it's quite an interesting way, in the way that some just come on and do practically nothing, just cast the vote, and others have sort of worked into the plot. And that was very well done. I thought it was very, very funny in the theatre. It does kind of be a bit sitcom at times, but you know, it was a really enjoyable experience. How that translates to television, and if you get that atmosphere that we had on TV, I think it'll be interesting to see. And I'm looking forward to watching it again. So I think a really unique experiment, which came off tremendously well. And, you know, it was exciting to be there and see it, and particularly see the first performance. And also, I think, despite the fact it's kind of quite a light-hearted story, it does make you think about the whole electoral process and how we cast our votes. And, you know, with a little stubby pencil on a piece of paper, it's very low tech given, you know, what it could be nowadays. And also the whole cross-section of different people you see, and you see in the polling station. I mean, when I went to vote on Thursday, I looked at my polling station in a completely new way. I was looking at the detail. Mine's in a sort of nursery school, and this one's set in a school gymnasium. And they'd got the look completely spot on. They'd got the people, the cross-section of people, and the people working there completely spot on. I think really an incredible achievement, really. And, you know, Haribo sweets used as a theatrical metaphor as well. Not seen that before, and used very effectively without spoiling why they're used. But it's all part of the storyline that leads from this mistake made at the beginning. So, yeah, I think Josie Rourke's got a kind of complete get-out-of-jail-free card for a long time with me now after this. I think it's quite an amazing thing.
I unfortunately didn't get to sit in the theatre. I did have to watch it on television. One of the things I've thought about that is that it didn't seem to lose an awful lot. You did feel a lot of the time you were, you know, almost part of the audience. I mean, you get them actually much better view when they film it because they've got much, much better angles. You're not always sat in the right place and they are zooming in on people and stuff like that. It does help an awful lot getting the concentration. But we were watching the audience there, and a lot of the time I did find myself laughing when they were laughing, not just because they were laughing, but almost feeling that I was in there. I think it helps that I've got a nice big television, so it does feel fairly immersive once you're there. The play itself I did find rather slight and rather predictable. I think outside the sort of meta-theatrical stuff, it being real time, you having lots of famous people on there, it is a rather slight piece. It's a rather slight farce. It's all a bit predictable, I thought, all a bit mechanical. But other than that, as you say, it's a wonderful insight into the idea of voting, and the way that the evening is constructed did seem to be rather clever and rather magical in many ways. But when I sat back and thought about the play itself, it is, yeah, it's just a little bit silly. And there's quite a lot of the unsophisticatedness of the voting combined with the self-importance of it. I found that a little bit alien. I didn't feel that the people who, when I voted on Thursday, was just a job, and it didn't feel that special. And I think they tried to make it feel special in the play, and tried to make it feel a lot more serious and much more significant. And I suppose it is in many ways a lot more significant, the individual voting. As it turned out, if they were in an orange and red Haribo marginal, it wouldn't have made a damn bit of difference, because nobody would have picked the orange Haribo or the yellow Haribo. After the event, you did sort of think, well, yes, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter which Haribo sweet you pick.
I mean, I think the thing is, as a play, yeah, I do agree about the thing that it's slightly slight, but it's an enjoyable thing. And it's one of those things you think, well, can this ever be done again now? Because, one, it has a huge cast, which would be great for an amateur company to do, because you can give loads of people parts. But it was the conceit of doing it live and live on TV, you know, 2 weeks later, and that being the first night and also the last night. So I don't think it will perhaps travel in time. And also because of the political situation now, it's not going to be something that lasts or can really be remounted, I would have thought, or revived. And the doing it live thing has been done now. So, you know, I'd be interested to know what other events could be done in that way. But as a one-off and to combine the theatre and TV together, it was great. But it's an enjoyable piece of fun, really. And also, I thought it was quite good because it doesn't have a sort of political bias. It you know, given it's the Donmar, it's quite even-handed. There's a pop at everybody, really, in it, which I thought was quite funny. And there's some very nice little cameos. The lesbians who were celebrating their anniversary who come in slightly drunk and sort of trying to take selfies in the polling station, celebrate one because one of them's Russian. It's her first time she's voted here. I thought there were some really nice little touches like that. So, yeah, a lot of fun. And if you heard some church bells in the background there, my church's going off. That's next door to my polling station. So that's how close I am to my polling place.
Perhaps it's worth mentioning a couple of other performances. I mean, Paul Shahidi as an independent candidate. He's an actor everybody needs to know about and or everybody needs to look forward to any time he's there because he makes everything special, I think. He's a really always a good presence in a play.
Oh, yeah, completely agree. I mean, his is probably the funniest cameo of the lot because he plays an independent character who's fighting a one-way system. Was it One Way, No Way, I think his slogan is. And again, yeah, I agree. When I saw he was on the list, I thought he's such a show stealer, and he does here, I think. I mean, he was a brilliant Olivia in the All Male 12th Night at the Globe, which went on to Broadway, and I think he got a Tony nomination there as well. He's terrific, absolutely brilliant.
And also the other thing was the big minor part is of course Judi Dench.
Yeah.
But one of the things I really enjoyed was the chemistry she has with her daughter. If I was a playwright or I could commission playwrights, I would just say, can we have something with those two?
Yeah.
Because those two rowing, it's just so it was just so wonderful, I thought.
Yeah, I think it's the first time they've acted together or acted on stage together, certainly. And yeah, I agree. I mean, they were a good teaming and you feel they've got a kind of that chemistry is there naturally. And also because of the characters they were playing, won't give too much away about their characters. She's, a retired doctor or something in it. And again, there's another mix-up. And I thought it was rather clever the way that, you know, there is, of course, it's Judi Dench, the build-up to her coming on, and then they keep her on till the end. So, you know, you kind of get more for your money of her than you do of some of the other characters who are sort of on and off quite quickly. And also I thought Hadley Fraser as the drunk, he was very good. And the posh couple, one of whom is played by Rosalie Craig, were funny. Jackie Clune as well, some really good cameos in it.
We're now going to talk about a couple of plays, No Milk for the Foxes and Beyond Caring. I'm linking these together, first of all, because I'm in a position where we're talking about them solo, but also that they are kind of thematically linked because they both deal with what it's like to work under zero-hour contracts. So, Web Cowgirl, tell me more about No Milk for the Foxes.
No Milk for the Foxes was billed as basically an attempt to address the lack of theater that realistically depicts working class people. The theater makers they'd specifically referred to a play that they'd seen at the National where they were trying to show what working class people were like, but in fact, they just strung a bunch of slang together and had the guy sort of like wave his hands around and wear his trousers low on his hips. But it was just sort of a caricature rather than looking at the fact that people who aren't, you know, middle or upper class actually have interesting lives, have interesting things going on in them. And if I'm dead honest, that would normally be to me a reason to run away from a show because I don't like to think of myself as being interested in shows based upon their class. I think I'm interested in interesting stories. And I worry about seeing shows that are so worried about politics that they basically forget to be, you know, an interesting play. But I am actually concerned about a lot of the issues that, as it turns out, this play was about. But what this play is really about is two guys who work together in a dead-end job and hang out together in the break room and talk about all sorts of, generally speaking, really lighthearted things. Sometimes they talk about the family. Sometimes they talk about ridiculous stuff about their jobs, meaningless humdrum stuff, the kind of thing where, like, if you were at a fast food restaurant, it'd be like, hey, you didn't refill the cups again. Little workplace etiquette things like, you didn't make me tea, or you did make me tea, and those kind of sort of resentments that build up over time. And as a depiction of actual work and what the day-to-day condition of working is actually like, I thought this play was really good and fun and realistic. You don't actually normally see plays that look at, you know, the humdrum details of what it's really like to work on a day-to-day basis. But as a story, it's about the developing friendship between these two guys, Mark and Sparks. Interestingly enough, they kind of get off on the wrong foot with a casually racist comment from Mark about whether or not Sparks was having a difficult time protecting himself from sunburn based upon his skin color. And actually, I thought that was a really well-handled piece of realistic theater in terms of how you have these really, like, difficult and weird conversations. But to me, it just kind of showed that they were both really normal people. And as the play carries on, you begin to see that there's a bit of a story happening in terms of what Mark is sort of trying to do with his life and how he's actually trying to make it better, and how Sparks, who doesn't care about this job and doesn't seem to have any plans for his life, seems to be somehow making better friends with the boss than the guy who actually cares about his job. And as you listen to Mark talk about his plans for his girlfriend and how he wants to get a place where they both can live and things like that, and as Sparks carries on talking about, you know, hanging out with the boss and talking to him, you start to wonder, what's going to be happening with the two of them? Does the person who's doing a good job and care a lot, you know, is he going to get his reward? Hanging over it all is the fact that they can all have their contracts changed at any minute. And they never know from 1 week to the next how much they're going to work. And I used to work in a situation like that when I was 19 and I was working at a fast food restaurant. And we could be sent home in the middle of the shift. We could find out we had absolutely no shifts for the next month, for the next week. It made it impossible to do any planning. And watching these guys, what you're seeing is that it's really difficult to actually try to have a life when you're working in this kind of a situation. And it's really soul destroying. But they don't sit around and complain about their souls being destroyed. And they don't have hugely deep and painful conversations about politics in a way that's supposed to be, you know, sort of educating the audience. They act like real people, except for one little thing, which is in between the scenes where they're talking about the tea and the coffee, or talking about, is a union a good thing or a bad thing? Or what do you mean you went out and had drinks with the boss? The guys have these little breaks where they sit and they rap. So one of the guys will do the sort of human beatbox thing where he makes the funny, like, spluttering and noises. And the other guy raps on top of it and talks about, sometimes it's stuff about the scene they just did. Sometimes it's just kind of like reflections on what the world is like. And to me, I was listening to it and thinking, maybe this is the birth of a new kind of musical. A musical that actually looks at how people do their music today, which isn't bursting into a really melodic song, but like doing a rap. And I actually thought the guy's rapping style seemed very realistic, like the kind of thing that people might just do for fun. And I'd like to imagine that in seeing this show, which I thought was very honest and yet not in the least bit boring, that perhaps what I was seeing was the birth of a new kind of musical that really works for the 21st century, as well as having, you know, a little bit of sort of thought about, man, work just sucks. And it's funny, you think they can't find ways to make it worse, but they still do. I thought it was a really great show and thought it was well worth talking about. Tim, you say you saw another show about 0 hours contracts?
First of all, we should say that that, of course, was on at the Camden People's Theatre, which was not. Yes, the play I saw was Beyond Caring at the National Theatre in their temporary space. This is presented by the Yard Theatre and is written by Alexander Zeldin and devised with the rest of the company. This, again, is the idea of four people who are on a night shift at a meat factory. And what we have is three women coming in. They've all been sent there by an agency on what is a zero-hour contract. Essentially, they have got 2 weeks' work, and they are expected to work their way through the night shift and, in some cases, pull double shifts at extremely short notice. The three women who we meet, they're sort of three different types. There's one who seems fairly normal and even possibly even middle class, but we slowly discover that she may in fact be homeless and her finances are intensely precarious. In fact, all of them are. Another one has arthritis but has been ATOS'd into work, been sort of made to work because they haven't got their disability living has been turned off. And a third has a family, is dislocated from her home in Liverpool and is sort of having to work in this factory. And these are all, in many ways, fairly desperate women looking for a job which is not particularly well paid. They are joined by two men. One is a permanent cleaner who, through various struggles of his own, has landed up in this job, having had a reasonably good job once, but now spends his life living quietly and reading Dick Francis novels. And then they have their manager, who is probably younger than all of them and a bit of an idiot, as often we find with managers, and really doesn't care about them. And perhaps he can't care about them because he has no control over how they're paid. He has no control over what they're paid. He just has control of them while they're working for him, and there is no other control. They all can't really control their environment, and it is very frustrating for them. And it does show, as you said, how bad, you know, the zero-hour contract can be, the idea that they can't, that they can be mucked around by the people who employ them, the people who pay them. That they can be either made to work an awful lot or just said, no, sorry, we're not going to let you work and you have to go away and do something. And often the people who boost zero-hour contracts say that, well, you know, it's wonderful. They're lovely and flexible. You can work whenever you want. And it would be okay if you are truly flexible and you know, you've got enough of a buffer of savings or something to tide you over when you don't actually have any work. But they're not good when you're basically being forced to work for long periods of, and if you don't work, you don't get paid at all. And it's really unacceptable. And this is done very powerful in this play. I think the only thing I had a problem with, and I don't think other people have had a problem, the people who've reviewed it have had quite the problem I had with it, I thought there was only about an hour's worth of play here. They've got about an hour's worth of things to say. They've got a very powerful message behind them, the way that these vulnerable people are pushed around. But really, I didn't think they had more than an hour to say, and unfortunately it's 100 minutes long, so it's rather too long for them to spend on this play. And we get an awful lot of time sitting around waiting, and it rather, for me, made me feel that there wasn't enough there. You know, there's just not enough there. It was too boring. It was, in many times, there's too many longers where people are sort of sitting around doing nothing, or they're bringing in large amounts of equipment to clean and cleaning it. And you think, well, yeah, you know, I want more of the play. And it is also, they have this fragmentary way of doing things where we don't see the full story behind anybody. And that's okay, but it's not quite so okay where there's nothing else there, that you're sort of getting a fragment of story but you're really then having to sort of sit around until you get the next fragment of story. There's not enough of a really strong narrative there, and I thought that was a bit of a pity, but I think a lot of other people have found it very rewarding. We're now going to talk about A Mad World, My Masters by Thomas Middleton. This is the RSC's show done in association with the English Touring Theatre and has been touring around and stopped off at the Barbican for a couple of weeks to show it there. It's directed by Sean Foley, and he's decided to set it in Soho in London. Although I never think it matters that much. When this sort of thing's done well, it's done as an overlay, and I think in this case it's done as an overlay. They're not trying to make too much of a point about it. Julie, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
It's got the 1950s Soho feel to it, and as you say, it was a production that started in Stratford in 2013 at the Swan Theatre, resurrected, and then it's done the tour, including places like Bath and Darlington, and it's ended up at the Barbican. And that's just brilliant that the RSC are getting their work out there, because under Michael Boyd there was a bit of touring, but not to the extent that there is with Greg Doran, because this production finished last night and Death of a Salesman opened at the Noel Coward. So there's much more of their productions coming into London and touring round England, which I think is fantastic. I think setting this production in a 1950s Soho gave it quite a nice feel, and it's a bit like the thing Sean Foley did with One Man and Two Governors. You could see a lot of the kind of blocking and the same kind of ideas in A Mad World, My Masters, as he had in One Man and Two Governors, to the point that actually probably the funniest scene comes before the interval, and you do spend the second half really hoping that you're going to get another moment like that. So it's quite a complex plot in some ways. It's about a nephew, Dick Follywhit, who hasn't seen his uncle for years. And he's got a reputation for being sober and well behaved. But in the years between seeing his uncle and when we come across him, he started to hang around with a couple of other guys, a chauffeur and another character called Balzac. And the problem is that he starts to drink and have parties and have a lot of fun. So he decides, cocks up with these two other guys, a plot to go and rob his uncle, Lord Bountiful, who is actually quite a nice man, though with some dubious habits, but quite a forgiving man who has an open house all the time. So we have these scenes where these three are trying to dupe the uncle. There's other comic characters. There's the butler who's hard of hearing, so we have lots of jokes about his hearing aid. And then there's another plot with a prostitute, Truly Kidman, whose mother is her pimp, and she's setting up a rendezvous between the wife of one of the citizens and another man. In this, he's a priest, but he then pretends to be a doctor. So it's quite complicated. So you've got the wife who is pretending that she doesn't like men. She doesn't like the company of men. But then we get this rendezvous between her and this priest. And it's quite a raunchy moment, quite a funny moment. And it all ends up at the end where they move out of the 1950s Soho to a masquerade at Lord Bountiful's house, which turns out to be a Jacobean masquerade. So there's the irony of them all going back in time. But I think this is just great fun. There's lots of gags, lots of jokes, quite farcical. It starts off, if you're very observant, you'll notice three drunks amongst the audience who get rowdier and rowdier, and they end up on stage. There's wonderful singing in it as well, 1950s songs, Billie Holiday and songs like that. So overall, really good fun, really good production. One thing that has changed from Stratford is some of the actors have swapped round. So you've got Ben Deary playing the husband, and he was originally Balzac. You've got Joe Bannister coming into the company to play Dick Folliwhit, originally played by Richard Goulding, who, of course, is touring with Charles III. And Richard Goulding was really good in the part as well, so it was kind of a hard act for Joe Bannister to follow. And you've got David Rubens playing both the detective, and now he's playing the butler. So it's quite funny to see that the company have decided, or the directors, to swap them around slightly on this tour. I don't know what you thought, Tim.
I enjoyed it a lot, although I kept wondering, as I ever do, how close it was to the original. I have seen this play before. It was done at the Globe in 1998, so almost 20 years ago. And unfortunately, I've drawn a complete blank on it. I can't remember it at all. And it's a pity, because you've got some quite interesting people in there, like Jonathan Cecil and John McEnery and Anastasia Hill and David Fielder and David Rintoul. So it looks like it was a good cast, and I have to remind myself about it. But I was a little bit worried that there wasn't enough of the original in there. They do seem to be playing fast and loose, but every so often you think, this must be as it was. Unfortunately, this particular play of Thomas Middleton's not sort of freely available, as you might expect, on the internet. I couldn't find a text for it anyway to sort of read up and see how they've changed it, because sometimes it feels as if they've changed it a lot, and other times it doesn't feel as if they've changed it at all. And it's that kind of mix I would have liked to get my hands on. I don't think they've changed the plot too much. I think it is very much as it was. One of the interesting things, though, is that I found it rather like a restoration comedy in some ways. Certainly the sexual elements of it, more reminiscent of a sort of an early restoration comedy. You know, the restoration comedies where they were actually allowed to do sex, which is really before William and Mary, if you know your restoration comedy. And it did remind me an awful lot of that kind of play, the kind of play where, you know, sex is happening just off stage and stuff like that, or in another room. I mean, in this one, it's sort of happening on a big bed on the stage, which is quite good fun. But it almost feels out of time and out of the usual Jacobean feeling that you get for some plays. And also, there is always the worry with, I think I've said this before, the worry I have with Jacobean plays about the fact that they were performed by, you know, all the women were performed by young boys, and the aristocracy at the time rather liked the idea that they were being performed by young boys and not really performed by women. I think, though, that this is, you have much greater feeling of a slightly later period when women are allowed to be women on stage, and I thought that was much more powerful. But it is extremely entertaining and very funny, and people were having a great time. The only thing I had, a slight thing I had, as I say, it's just, I kept wondering, well, how much of this is real, what they changed. But of course, reminding me that it was Sean Foley who did One Man, Two Governors, and you have Spunky, the old retainer, with the hearing aid. There was, of course, a big gag in One Man, Two Governors with the waiter, the very old waiter, who would fall downstairs every night. I mean, that was obviously played by a much younger man. So I think there's a slight echo there, and he does seem to like being in this time period, Sean Foley. So it'd be, it's a rather shame that we don't get enough RSC stuff in London anyway. I mean, I know we're getting the Death of a Salesman shortly, but we're not getting enough. We don't get the RSC for long enough, and it's rather a pity there. But hopefully when because I think they are moving back towards the Barbican, or, you know, into the Barbican at some point. So hopefully we'll get a bit more.
Yeah, they've done a deal, haven't they, 2020, to use the Barbican. But we've got Oppenheimer as well, so it is starting to improve.
Yeah. You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page at Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com, and the podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you, goodbye.